My name is Tiffany, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of our group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Alan will read the preamble.
I'm Alan, I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Eddie will read the steps.
Good evening. My name is Eddie, and I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. Thanks. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Sally will read the traditions.
Thank you. Thanks. Hi, I'm Sally, and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9 AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Hannah.
Hi, my name is Hannah, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 21st, 2007. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. I'm on step 9, and my sponsor is Elizabeth. I'm going to start by telling you how I got here. I was born in Vermont on a farm. I was a farm girl. I don't seem like it now. It was a dairy farm, and I would wake up early and watch my mom milk the cows, and we were there till I was about 6 years old. Then we moved around a little bit, and then ended up in Colorado, where I grew up through high school. I was always really shy and really quiet. I always just wanted to stay home, be with my mom, be safe, really scared of the world, was artistic, and always felt like I really wasn't as good as everybody else because I wasn't social. I didn't think I was as pretty as the other girls. I had a hard time fitting in. I was very insecure. When I was 16, my mom passed away of brain cancer. Well, that was very difficult, needless to say. And I think things changed in my life. That was the first time I ever had any kind of spiritual feelings. I hadn't grown up religious at all, and I didn't really believe in God or really think about God, or just I didn't even think about it. But then when my mom passed away, all of a sudden I just completely believed that there was life after death and that when I died, I was going to be with her. And just completely believed that. I looked back and there was just no, I just believed in life after death and in God. So after a few years, I stopped believing that. I don't know if I needed it in the moment to get through that time. But I went back to being not spiritual and not believing in God, except occasionally if I was angry at God, then I believed in him. After she died, I started drinking a lot, pretty much through high school, pretty much every day. I would drink and use drugs. I would show up intoxicated to school almost every day. I thought it was fun. I thought it was cool for a while, but really by the time I graduated, I was really depressed, really down. I had gotten really bad grades in school and barely graduated, and I felt terrible about myself. As soon as I graduated, I did my first geographical, and I went to Southeast Asia for 6 months. After that, I got back to Colorado and right away moved again. I moved to California. I didn't know a single person in California. I just thought, seems cool, I'll just go there. Even better that I don't know anybody, I won't have to deal with anybody or talk to anybody, because I was just terrified of people and thought that no, you know, I was just insecure. So, let's see. I went and just camped out in California for a couple years and pretty much just kept to myself and didn't really talk to anybody. Really isolated, and didn't really drink. I sort of stopped for a couple years. After a couple years, I kind of started drinking again, became a little bit more social, started to make some friends, just drinking friends. And I started dating a guy who was an alcoholic, and we used to drink all the time. And he shot himself in the head when he was 23 and I was 24. So I had kind of another blow. You know, it's been very hard for me to have faith now in AA because I just lost faith. I really lost any belief that if there was something that was going to that was a higher power, it wasn't going to take care of me. So I'm going to try to move on with the story. After that, I continued to drink, probably more and more. Before I came into AA, not long before that, I stopped being able to show up to work because I would be drinking all the time. And after I stopped going to work, I just drank all the time. And was pretty much never sober, ever. That was really hard. It scared me. I went really far down spiritually. I was more dead than alive, just using drugs, and couldn't stand myself so much. I couldn't stop drinking and using drugs because I would have to face what I had become, and that was really terrifying. I was urged by my brother to come visit him here in New York, and I did in last July, and I haven't left yet. I tried to get sober here. I failed miserably. I pretty much right away was just back drinking and disappearing for days at a time. My brother and his wife were very worried. I felt bad about myself, and one day I woke up just so miserable. I went and saw a counselor that I had been seeing, and I just said, okay, I'll do whatever you say. And he said, go to AA. So I went to my first meeting on September 21st, and it's been a really incredible, incredible ride up until now. My life has changed completely. The program has given me so much. It's given me everything that I have. Because when I came in here, I had nothing. So, to that, I owe it a lot. And it's wonderful, and it's fun. It's very challenging and scary, but I'm growing. I got a sponsor on my third day sober. I started working the steps. The steps have changed me in a lot of ways. They've built a lot of confidence. They've taught me so much about life and so much a better way to live, not just by not drinking, but with every relationship that I have. They've changed my whole perspective on life, my whole perspective on myself and where I fit in life. Life was really a bleak, desperate, sad place for me before, and now it's not easy, but it's hopeful. It's not easy, but I know instead of on a path going just down, 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 I'm on a path going up. However slow it might be, I'm on the right path, and I can at least have confidence and relax knowing that. I call my sponsor every day. Sponsors are great. They're really hard, though. My sponsor sometimes I think is the best sponsor in the world. Sometimes I hate my sponsor, and I think literally she's just trying to ruin my life. There's no other explanation for what she's doing. But every day it changes, and every day my relationship with her grows, and she's been the most supportive, one of the most supportive people in my whole life, and that's amazing to me. What else do? I have commitments. Commitments allow me to meet tons of people and make me actually feel like I fit in here and I'm a part of it. And that's a wonderful feeling that I never had, from never talking to anybody to having all these people that wish the best for me. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Marty.
Hi, I'm Marty, and I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is February 25th, 2008. My sponsor is Rich G, and I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. And trying to work step 9 and 10. 2 10-minute speakers from rural areas. I grew up in Wyoming, and I'm in New York, so that automatically qualifies as geographics. I never fit in, I felt. Grew up in a family that practically gave me everything I wanted. I learned how to work when I was in the 5th grade. And my mother's family came from California area, originally New York, California. My father in Wyoming. So I was lucky I got to travel out of Wyoming and go to Los Angeles at least once a year. And as I got older, it's exactly what I wanted to do. 13, 14, starting to drink. And there's always somebody older to teach you to drink. It was Coors. You still taste it. And 15, 16, in the mid-80s, L.A. was hot, and I wanted to move there and change my name to Max Rage. And some of these guys, though, they have reunion tours, but I'm glad I didn't go. I waited. I came out to New York after I graduated high school, and went to college out here. High school, I can tell one story that pretty much sums a lot of it up. I really just wanted to fit in, and just having no idea how far I'd go to do that. Drinking the biggest bottle of Blue Maui, I didn't realize how much alcohol was in it. With 2 other guys, they had their own bottle as well, and we're heading to a dance. And at this point, I've given up all sports, which I was decent at in junior high, and there's too much politics. I grabbed a skateboard and swimming. Those were sort of individual sports that helped the collective team out, but it was individual. I gave all that up, and I don't know, picked up cigarettes, and booze was cool, drinking, and Metallica, t-shirts, just looking bad, thanks. And who needs LA when you got this crowd? I got really sick that night after the moshing, the slam dancing didn't happen, but the slow dance, it was like Eagles for like 7-8 minutes long, the Hotel California. And I had to vomit, and I hit every stall in the boys' bathroom. I was caught. I I ran home, which was a couple blocks away, this is Wyoming, in the snow without my jacket, and my mother's there to greet me. Get back in the car, we're going to get your jacket. It's like, how does she know? School called. And I spent the next 3 days in in-house detention with the bad kids. And the whole time I'm in there, I'm thinking, oh, Lord, what have I done? And people are going to, I'm not pleasing them. I get out, and I'm cool. And that was the rest of high school. I played in bands. No sports. The jocks were okay. We all drank at the same keg out in the middle of nowhere. Came out to New York, and I immediately wanted to quit college and just hang out in the city. That didn't happen for another couple years. I did that to play in a band out west. Finally got that worked out. So back to the west in New York the past 13 years, a good 6-7 times. Lost the bands, lost a wife. And this last time I came out, I did not come back to New York to get sober. I came back to party. And I joined AA instead, but I'd spent a year in Wyoming last year as an adult in my parents' place. So I'm 32 at my parents' and going through a divorce. And I work for a Coors Brewing Company, and I proceed to get involved in other things too to help drinking. Same thing happened. I get bored. I'm just, you know, I'm not doing things. I'm not. I got to be the next big thing. I know it's going to happen this time. I'll be part of the next big movement in New York. Get out here, and yeah, it didn't happen. I spent the first couple months at a sublet, a friend of a friend's who just. It was everything. That decision, I'd already wasted about $400-some on a half month's rent at the place where I always go to. And I chose to go to a place instead. I went to a sublet. That decision that night, before that, I decided not to go drinking with my running buddies. Decided not to continue drinking. I just went home and I finally said no. Things had to change. I just didn't know what to do this time. I actually went to a psychologist and I can't stand them. I don't know anything about them, but I can't stand them. I study their stuff as a layman, but I can't stand them. And I just do it. And I said, I don't know what to do. Everybody I know in New York is bad for me. And I said, well, what about AA? And it's like, oh, yeah, AA. And I'm from Wyoming. In the Saturday paper, which is also the Sunday paper, thanks. It'll list the different AA meetings. I remember seeing that as a growing up. And they're far in between. So I, you know, had the typical thought of smoking. Like, I don't smoke anymore. Quit that a couple years ago. So I possibly couldn't go to it's New York. Forget about the whole public smoking thing. You can't do that. And anyway, I made the appointment. I went. Told me about AA, and told me about a particular group at 60th and Park. And going on Tuesday night. This was a Monday. I saw him, and there was no way I was going to go. But I was like, all right, that's great. Went online, found it. This meeting on Tuesday night was my first meeting, February 26th. And it was downstairs. And I tried to go in the back. Oh, actually, before that, if I can just back up, I went all the way around. I came off the subway over there in Lexington, and I saw the big group of people, and this was not it. It's like, there's way too many cool people out front. And so I went up to 61st, and then made my way around and circled back, and I just went inside. And there's another decision that happened again. Al-Anon was upstairs, and AA was downstairs. And Al-Anon or AA? And the coward in me would have went to Al-Anon, but I went to AA, went downstairs, went straight to the back, and tried to hide. Roland came out to get me, and he got me a seat up front. And behind me would be my sponsor. I went out with him that night, and we started talking about meetings. I had 7 meetings to go to, 6 meetings for the rest of the week. And I trusted this person. I had nowhere else to go. I've heard that. At that time, I really didn't. But again, to back up, was the whole, I knew there was going to be a great amount of people here. And everybody started standing up to say their day count. And I stood up, and I had 2 days. I stood up, and the crowd went wild. And at least to me, it went wild. And that was enough. I mean, my knees were knocking. And the next day, the psychologist asked me how I was doing, how it went. And I never met more sincere people in my life, especially somebody I didn't want something from and they didn't want for me, other than service. It's now been almost 5 months, and the service is, I've heard, you know, the one leg out, one leg in, and I've got 4 different commitments at different meetings, and it gets me to the meeting, it gets me to know people, and that's it. I mean, that's what keeps me sober, other than doing the steps. I call my sponsor. I'm just repeating myself. So thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Patty M.
Thank you. I love this. Thanks. Hi, my name is Patty, and I am an alcoholic. If you're new or if you're coming back, welcome. This is a great, great organization, and it's helped me stay sober for 21 years. I'm really grateful for that. My home group is the Fireside Saturday Step Meeting. And I also want to thank Bob for asking me to speak. Bob is one of the few people that I know in the rooms that I actually knew drunk. We both knew each other drunk. We worked together. And to kind of like fast forward in my story a little bit, I just want to tell you this funny little story when it can't come to Bob. When it comes to Bob. Well, anyway, Bob was working at this hotel that I was at, and I was in human resources, and my boss, probably about 3 months before, had called me on the carpet for being drunk as a skunk at an event, and being so drunk that he actually drove me home in his Bentley, carried me upstairs, and put me to bed, and I had no recollection of it whatsoever. So anyway, he insisted the next day that I get help. And, of course, I denied I was an alcoholic and that it was the first time it ever happened and so on and so forth. But anyway, so he saw to it that he decided that our corporation, our hotel company, needed an EAP program. And I was going to be ahead of that EAP program. And so he had his secretary arrange for me to, because I was supposed to do it, and, of course, I never did. He had a secretary arrange for me to go to all these rehabs all over New England and talk to people and watch films and look at alcoholic livers and all this other stuff. So I did all that, and I thought it was really fascinating, and I considered myself an expert on alcoholism when I finished doing that. Anyway, so as a result of that, we had a great EAP program, and Bob was our first attendee. And I'll never forget the day, because I love Bob, and he, drunk or sober, he had the most amazing sense of humor, and he came into the office, and he was just shaking, and he was with his union delegate, and, he's shaking, and he's telling me, he tells me he has a problem with cocaine, and of course, I'm the expert, and I say to him, well, I understand you have a problem with cocaine, and we're going to help you with that, but of course, you probably have an alcoholism problem. And Bob's like, no, absolutely not, I don't have a problem with alcoholism. But needless to say, he went away, and he got some great, great help, and he came back, and here he is sober, and I'm still drinking up a storm. And I don't know if he knew I was alcoholic or not. Probably did. Most of the employees did. But anyway, when I finally got sober and I walked into one of my first rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous up in Boston, Bob was there, and Bob was making coffee. And I didn't think that I was an alcoholic yet. But I was there to help. And so when I said that to Bob, he just had that look, like, yeah, sure. And so it wasn't long after that, and he showed me how to make coffee and all this other stuff, and it wasn't long after that that I got really involved in the rooms. And what was also wonderful is that I had to go to a lot of banquet events. I worked in a hotel, and I was an executive there. And whenever I was at an event, somehow Bob always got to be at my table. He was always the banquet captain at my table. And I would sit down. As soon as I sat down, the wine glasses would disappear. Now, I was counting days at this time. I was holding on by a shoestring, but Bob was there. And I'll be forever grateful for that. Anyway, a little bit about Bob and me. So anyway, the two other speakers, I had to chuckle because they're from urban areas or rural areas, and I'm from northern Maine. Can't get any more rural than that, at least in the United States. And, you know, I grew up in an alcoholic house. My great-grandfather was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. Three uncles are alcoholic that I know of, and there are probably many more out there, you know, someplace. So I kind of look at it as like I really didn't have a shot. But I grew up, I was the middle child, I was the only girl, and we grew up in a house that was filled with secrets. We lived with my grandparents, and my family was pretty influential. I'm sorry, I have braces, just got them, so I can't speak too well. They were pretty well known in the town. My dad was the mayor of the town, and so everything kind of stayed in the house, and so this is just part of my story, and if some of you are offended by it, I apologize, but it's my story. So part of growing up there is that from the age of 4 to the age of 14, I was sexually and physically and emotionally abused by my older brother. And I told my parents about it when I was 4 years old, and they said I was dreaming. And I told them again, and they said I was dreaming. And so from that very young age, I questioned reality. I questioned my reality. You know, I questioned my thoughts. I questioned anything about, you know, who I was. And I became this little Pollyanna, this little girl that, you know, I was 4 years old, 5 years old. I was serving cocktails to, you know, my parents' friends. And I had a little black pair of patent leather shoes, little white socks with little ruffles on them, little, you know, pleated skirt and stuff. And I made people laugh. You know, I couldn't laugh, but I made people laugh. And, things went on. When I was 8 years old, something else happened that was very tragic. I was raped. And, you know, I started drinking when I was 12. You know, and a therapist told me once that, you know, said, Patty, I'm surprised you didn't start drinking at 8. But when I was 12, I needed that drink. You know, I was running away from memories I didn't want to remember. And my very first drink, I blacked out. You know, I drank half a can of Narragansett beer. I don't think I drank any more than that because I don't remember. But then again, maybe I did. But that particular night, you know, my mom gave me a 16-ounce can of Narragansett beer, and it was a harvest party. I grew up in a farm community, what can I say? And she said, this is all you drink. Don't drink anything else. Don't drink anything anyone gives you. Just drink this. And that's what I did. And I drank a quarter of the can, and I was laughing, and I was able to talk to boys. And, you know, I made people laugh. And by the time I got to half a can, like I mentioned, I don't remember. I found out the next day that, you know, coming home that night, I was in the back of a pickup truck with my best friend. I peed in the back of the pickup truck going 50 miles an hour coming down the mountain. And I have no idea how I got home. I have a vague recollection of slipping on the rug in my living room, falling down in front of my parents. No one said a word. And after that night, 12 years old, I chased that drink. And I continued to chase it until I was 32 years old. I started immediately hanging out with a different crowd. I was always very popular in school, never understood why, felt terrible about myself, hated myself. You know, as I got older, I was wearing boys' clothing. I was wearing huge clothing just to kind of hide, you know, disappear someplace. And now, when I graduated from school, there was so many jackpots, you know, and arrested by the cops and all this other good stuff. And, you know, 16 years old and drinking with, you know, a cousin and my best friend, a quart of Southern Comfort. To this day, I can't smell Southern Comfort. I hate the smell of it. We had tumblers with whiskey sour mix, and we mixed those Southern Comforts, and All I remember that night is falling into a huge mud puddle in front of my dad's office at probably about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock in the morning. I was going to, walking up to a guy I had a crush's house. I was serenading him outside his window. Didn't go very well with the town, I'll tell you right now. And we made it back to my friend's house, and we passed, well, before we passed out, we, you know, we each got sick in different areas of the house. And that night, we all fell asleep in the same bed, woke up the next morning, and the bed was wet. One of us had wet the bed. To this day, we still don't know who, and we still blame it on each other. You know, it's, no, it was this one, no, it was that one, it was that one. But that tells you a little bit. Here I am now, 16 years old, and I'm blacking out. I'm doing things that I would never have done before. And that was a lot of my drinking. I did things, I took risks. That I would never, ever, ever have done. I ended up in situations that I shouldn't have ended up, and I shouldn't be standing here talking to you today, except by, you know, God's grace. Fast forward, I leave this small town. I go to school in Boston, and my dad puts me in this little nunnery, I used to call this dormitory, all-girls dormitory, So I was in a room with about there were five of us in this small room, and my room was on the fire escape, and that's all I needed, you know. I drank in the bars in Kenmore Square. The curfew was 10 o'clock at night, and we would come back, curfew, 10 o'clock, sign in, yep, say hi to the house mother, everything's fine, and go right back down the fire escape and go back to the bars in Kenmore Square and hanging out in Katie's and the Ratskeller and all these, you know, Molly's and all these other places. And what the thing with my drinking, you know, I look back now, and or I've looked back many times through going through the steps, but one of the things that really hit me and also was very sad was that I would go into a place, I would order, you know, usually beer, that's all I could afford, and back then it was pretty cheap. I would order that, usually a pitcher with a bunch of other people or whatnot, and I'd start drinking, and then it'd be, okay, fine, I'll see you later. And I'd go across the street to the bar across the street, and then I'd go to the other bar across the street, and then I'd come back to this bar, and then I'd go to that one, and then I'd go to this one. And I remember talking to a sponsor of mine, my first sponsor, Kathy, about that when I was getting sober and doing work. And I realized today that what that was is that there was a gaping hole inside me that I was looking so, I was searching so, so hard to find something to fill that hole inside me. And what my sponsor said was that the only thing to fill that hole would be God. That was the only thing that would fill that hole of utter loneliness and despair. And that no amount of booze, no amount of food, no amount of men, nothing, clothes, shoes, whatever, was going to fill that hole except God. Fast forward again, graduated from college, married a guy, both drunks. On my wedding night, I wasn't carried over the threshold, I was dragged because I was so drunk he couldn't carry me. And the next morning on our honeymoon trip, I mean, we're stopping the car every 10 miles so I can throw up. It's like, okay, stop, throw up, keep on going. It was the worst next day that I could possibly remember. I didn't want to get married. You know, I have this picture in my wedding album that I'm sitting at the altar, and some of my friends know this story. I'm sitting at the altar. This is how crazy I was. I was 21 years old, and my husband's sitting there. We're not married yet, and I look over at him, and I said, you realize this isn't going to work, don't you? And the look of horror on his face was captured on film. And I still have it to this day, my wedding. I have to keep that one. I couldn't throw it out. But that's, I just thought, I was 21, I thought it would be easy. You know, get married doesn't work, divorce. And it didn't work that way. It really didn't work that way. Fast forward some more, divorce, relationship, 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 other relationship, more relationships. Every single one of those relationships, when I was drunk, I left. Well, let me put it this way. I left as the victim. I thought, oh, poor me. Look what they did. They beat me up. I did this. They cheated on me. They did that. They did this. It was all about them. All about them. And when I got sober, I had to look at that stuff, you know. And you know, by the grace of God, you guys will all stay sober, and you have an opportunity to do that. And it was wonderful for me to be able to do that, because for the first time, I was able to see my part in it. And trust me, there was a lot of my part in every single one of those breakups. So anyway, fast forward some more. I was definitely an overachiever. I became an executive at a very young age. I was 21 years old when I got my first executive position, and no one knew how old I was, and that was fine with me. You know, outwardly, professionally, I was very mature. You know, emotionally, I was, you know, just like three or something along those lines. And, you know, when I came in these rooms, I always said I never drank at work. But then I remembered that, and this is probably when I was 5 years sober, I remember that I had a bottle of vodka in my bottom desk drawer. And that usually about 5 o'clock, I would send my assistant out to the cafeteria to get a 2 styrofoam cups with ice. You didn't know this, Bob, did you? And she would come back, and I'd sit at the desk, and I would take the bottle of vodka out and pour us each a drink. Now, mind you, I was the corporate director of human resources. I fired people for drinking on the job. I didn't see anything wrong with this, and I drank. You know, I drank as I was doing whatever work I was doing, and then I would go up to the bar and drink. You know, I had an unlimited expense account. I drank a lot in the hotel that I worked at. I had a lot of jackpots in the hotel. One last, you know, crazy controlling, I don't have a problem story was every night my colleague and I would go up to Copley's bar, and we would order these tumblers of white wine. And I would drink, you know, at first I was drinking maybe 2 drafts of wine, didn't have a problem. And after a very short period of time, I would get through half a glass, and literally I would call it, I would hit a brick wall. And that's, I would jokingly say, you know, I just hit a brick wall. There's something terribly wrong with the wine. And so I spoke with the food and beverage director, and I said, you know, there's something wrong with the wine, and I think we need to do something about it. And, you know, Maureen's having the same problem. It's not just me. And so he said, you know, well, maybe there's a lot of sediment that's, you know, clogging the wine hose or whatever. And he said, you know, we'll have those cleaned. So they had them cleaned. Now, mind you, it's not like it's a little hose this big. It's a really long hose going to the basement. And then I was drinking wine again, and I was still hitting that brick wall. And I said, you know what? There's something terribly wrong with this wine. What does he do? He replaced the hose. And it still didn't make a difference, so I switched to vodka. And, you know, I started out with vodka and tonic, and then I would, with lime, of course, and then I would say that it was the lime that was giving me the problem, and so I stopped using the lime, and then it would be the tonic, so I stopped using the tonic, so I was drinking straight vodka, and then I stopped drinking in the bar. And I would drink vodka right out of my freezer. And I would keep the bottle in the freezer. And, you know, that's the other thing in sobriety that I remembered. And I think I remembered this when maybe I was about 13 years sober. I always knew I kept vodka in the freezer, but I always thought it was a fifth. Fifth of vodka. That sounds kind of doable, that would be a normal thing to do, huh? No, I kept a half gallon of vodka in my funeral, in my freezer. It was like, and I did that until one day one of my friends was over or whatnot. We were having a party. And I take the you know, bottle of vodka out of my freezer, the half gallon, and she goes, "You have a half gallon of vodka in your freezer?" And I was like, oh, I just bought that. I just put that in there. And after that, I went out and bought a bottle, a fifth, and then I would take the half gallon and fill the fifth of vodka and put that in my freezer just in case someone looked in my freezer. God forbid should someone look in my freezer. So there was a lot of denial, as you can see, going on. There was a tremendous amount of denial. And, you know, the one of the straws that broke the camel's back was that story I told you about my boss, and he literally called me up to the office and asked me. He asked me, he said, you know, you did a great job last night. There was a great party and stuff like that. And he said, how'd you get home? And I had no clue. And that's when he told me that he'd give me a ride home in the Bentley and carried me upstairs and put me to bed. And he really sat there with me and said, you know, Patty, I think you have a problem with alcohol. You know, instead of being humble, you know, of course I immediately denied it, but I felt so much rage because I knew he had been arrested at least twice for a DWI. And how dare he call me an alcoholic when he had been arrested for a DWI twice? And so that was the grandiosity that was certainly there lurking. And very shortly after that, you know, I couldn't not look at my drinking, but so I quit drinking. I decided one morning I woke up and I looked in the mirror and I saw this bloated, disgusting person looking back at me, and I immediately said, okay, and I swear to God, you're either going to kill yourself or you're going to lose weight, one or the other. And so that afternoon, I left work, and I walked, I walked into the weight loss clinic on Boylston Street in Boston, or Newberry Street in Boston, and I said, okay, this is my problem, I need to lose weight. Well, being a good alcoholic, I went with a gusto. And within 4 months, I went from a size, probably 12, 13, something, you know, up there. And I ended up down to a size 2. I was wearing children's clothing. And I swear to God. And I was, you know, and I still, and I wasn't drinking. So I showed my boss, because part of this, you had to not drink, because drinking had calories. And so anyway, after those 4 months, I decided that I could have a glass of wine. So I had a glass of wine, which you know where that led to. Then I had another glass of wine. And with this program, you had to write your food down, or you had to write your calories down every day. So I decided to eliminate food, and I would count the calories of the vodka. And then how many olives I had in my vodka, I would count those too. And so that was my whole calorie count going there. So that was insane. But as a result of that, I ended up with a very, very severe eating disorder. I became anorexic, then I became bulimic. And, you know, that just was absolute, absolute insanity. And the last day of my drinking, last year of my drinking, actually, this was the typical day. I would wake up every morning at 5 o'clock. I would go out for an hour's run. I would come back and do an hour aerobics in the living room. I would usually binge and purge at work during the day, and then I would come home, I'd go for another hour's run, I'd do another hour of aerobics in the living room, and then I would drink myself into a stupor, you know, and I would, you know, somehow wake up sometimes on the rug, sometimes in my bed. But when I woke up every single day, I was so angry with God because I was still alive. I wanted to die so badly. That last year, I attempted suicide so many times. So many times. And during that period of time, when I began to realize that, you know, my brother kept looking at me and said, you know, Patty, there's something terribly wrong. You have no neck. You know, this, what's happening? And I just looked at myself, and I saw this fat, bloated person, and there was nothing left. There was nothing left. There was nothing inside me. There was nothing outside of me either anymore. And you know, I told my physician I had to go for a physical or something like that, and told my physician what I was doing, not the drinking, of course, but everything else. And so he made an appointment for me to go into this, get a psych evaluation, and unfortunately, it was a 30-day wait. I knew I wasn't going to make it, and every day I would call up that psych place and say, can you see me today? Can you see me today? And about 2 weeks into that, when I came into work one day, there was a message on my desk, and they said, if you can get here in the next 20 minutes, we can see you. And I went there, and I had my suit on, I had my Louis Vuitton bag, I had an incredible scarf that was just fabulous, earrings, makeup, everything, and I walked in, and I sat down, and I proceeded to tell them what I did the night before, and I attempted suicide again the night before. And I went through this whole thing, and she said, you know, you have a problem. And I said, you know, I know, I really need help. And she says, well, we're going to put you away. And I was like, what do you mean you're going to put me away? I was like, what do you mean you're going to give me? I, you know, I was expecting a pill, you know, maybe a couple days off work or something like that. What do you mean you're going to put me away? And she said, yeah, we're going to put you away. You need to go into a locked psych ward. I was like, whoa, 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 we're getting a little serious here. And so anyway, she wouldn't let me leave. She gave me a choice. You have a choice. I'm either going to pink slip you in, and that didn't sound good. And that's involuntary commitment, which was not good. It wouldn't look good on my record. That's exactly what I thought, too. Or you can go involuntarily. And I was like, okay, I think voluntarily would look better. And so I went back. They had to get the hotel nurse to come and get me because they didn't trust me. Went back to the hotel, and at that point, I was convinced I was only going to spend a week there, and the nurse kept on saying, yeah, Patty, that's true, you're only going to spend a week there. So make a long story short, I was there for 30 days, and I was actually in restraints the first night I was there. I was in a locked psych ward, and I wanted to die. That's all I wanted to do. I wanted to die. And in that locked psych ward was the first time I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. There was someone in that ward that had a number of years of sobriety that was there, and she was reading. She would read her 24-hour books and stuff like that. And, you know, I couldn't read at that point. I was so suicidally depressed that I couldn't read. I didn't know I couldn't read. I just thought it was stupid. I'd grown stupid. And so she would give me a book, and I would read a line, and have to read it again, read it again, reading it again. And there were these people that would come in to visit her, and they were happy, you know, and they made her laugh. And I was so alone. I had no one. I was so alone. And so when she left, she gave me her 24-hour book. And when she gave it to me, she said, here. And I was like, no, I don't need that. I'm not an alcoholic. And she said, you might not need it now, but you might need it someday. Just take it. And I still have that book today. It means a lot to me. I wish I could say when I walked out of that psych ward that I stopped drinking, but I didn't. And within 3 weeks, I was almost back there again. And because I wasn't ready to admit that I was an alcoholic, I knew that I was a bulimic, I knew I was anorexic, and I knew I wanted to kill myself. And, you know, I was able to get a lot of phenomenal help. And I got into the first 12-step program I got into was Al-Anon. And then I got into OA, and then I got into AA. Now, you might think, oh, this went through a period of years. No, this went through a period of 3 months. It was like bang, 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 bang. And, you know, I was gifted very early on with the desire to stay sober. You know, I didn't have that full desire to live. There was one little crack of hope that I thought that I might be able to be okay and live. You know, but I was filled with secrets that were killing me. And my sponsor got me involved in the steps immediately. In Boston, we have these very structured 12-step meetings that are closed. And they're called AWOLs. And I did one AWOL, went from start to finish, did my first fourth step. When I did my fifth step, the shame began to lessen. But I still had that desire to kill myself. I was going to 16 meetings a week. I was doing service at all three groups that I was in, not groups, but programs that I was in. I was, you know, doing everything that my sponsor told me. When I saw the steps up on the wall and I saw God up there, I was going to walk out. I was going to walk out because I believed there was a God, but I didn't believe there was a God for me. I believe my God had abandoned me a long time ago. And what my sponsor said to me, and I still see her today with these gorgeous, gorgeous big blue eyes that were smiling at me, and I wanted so desperately what she had. You know, she had joy in her life. I had nothing in my life except a condo and some clothes. That was it. I had nothing inside. I had a lot of outside stuff, but nothing inside me. And she said, Patty, if you don't believe today, it's okay. Just believe that I believe. Just believe that I believe. That's all you need is that little kernel. And I did that. I believed that she believed in a power greater than herself, you know. And as a result of that, I just kept on working the steps. And as I continued to work through the steps, I began to... I've always been a seeker. Even as a child, I was a seeker. But as in Alcoholics Anonymous, I became a seeker. I wanted to have that spiritual life that I heard you folks talk about. I wanted to have that peace. I wanted to be able to wake up in the morning and be happy to be alive and not wish I was dead. And so I sought different avenues. I went to different workshops. I meditated. I did, you know, I prayed every day. I got down on my knees. Even though I didn't believe that my God was there, you know, I got down on my knees and I asked for help every morning and I gave thanks to God every night. I went on spiritual retreats. I went on, you know, ACOA retreats. I did, you know, you name it. I was involved in it. You know, and there came a day that, and as time progressed, you know, I then believed that my higher power was up there someplace, was no longer this guy with the long white beard and the lightning bolt that would come down and hit me at any moment. And then I began to believe that there was kind of a cord. My higher power was there, and the cord was coming down into me someplace, into my stomach, I thought. And then I began to believe, and still believe today, that my higher power, the voice of my higher power is inside my heart. It's right here. And if I choose to listen, I can hear. I can hear what the message is, what I need to do in my life today to be a good person. You know, when I pray every day, when I walk to work every day, all I ask God every day is to be of service. You know, I don't ask God for things anymore. You know, I remember not too long ago, Scott R. was a very dear friend of mine, and he was dying. And I wanted, you know, I was like, God, please. And I was like, oh, God, help me be of service somehow to the people in his life, the people in my life. You know, I wanted so much to pray, you know, God, please give him a liver. Please don't let him die. Don't do this. And sometimes I would slip into that. I was like, you know what? all I can do is I can be there. I can be there for him. I can be there for his family. I could be there for my husband. And you know, as a result of having someone like that in my life, and you know, I learned so much from him, and I learned so much from the people that he sponsored. You know, I learned that even with 21 years of sobriety, that I have to continue seeking, that I can't sit down and rest on my laurels, that I have to continue doing the work. And the work is, it's not easy, but it's amazing. You know, I have joy in my life today. I don't want to kill myself. You know, I don't want to, and I also don't want to kill anyone else, which is really good. But, you know, that's a miracle to me that I can wake up and I can say that. You know, in sobriety, I remarried. You know, my husband and I will be married 10 years in October. And I've learned so much from him in the last, you know, several years. You know, I learned from watching him grow also in his spiritual journey that he's taken on. And it reminded me that, you know, that my spiritual journey doesn't stop just because I'm sober. If anything, I have to work even harder, you know, being, you know, 21 years sober, because I can pick up a drink as easily as anyone else can pick up a drink if I sit down and just rest on my laurels, is that I have to be there. I have to be there. I have to show up for myself, and I have to show up for people in my life. And that's only people in the rooms. Those are people at work. Let's see. That's, in case you can't tell, I'm really grateful to be sober. You know, this has been a ride. And if you're new, if you're coming back, you know, just sit back. And one of the most important slogans for me was the acronym of HOW, honesty, openness, and willingness. You know, and I had to get that really quickly. I had to get that really, really quickly. I had to be honest with myself. I had to be honest with other people. I had to be open about what I was feeling. And I had to be willing to do whatever it took. Whatever it took. So if you're new, if you're coming back, remember that slogan, HOW, honesty, openness, and willingness. And thank you.